Welcome to the Powered by Hearts podcast. My name is Brie McDermott-King, and in this podcast, I get to speak to the University of Hertfordshire's most inspiring graduates about how they overcame their biggest challenges and to learn how they achieved their professional success. I'll also be helping you get ahead in your own careers with specialist advice from Hearts experts. In today's episode, we're going to talk about leadership, specifically what good leadership looks like. And I'm extremely honoured to be joined by Dr. Rachel Moses, who is a Hearts graduate. So Rachel graduated back in 2001 with a physiotherapy degree. Rachel now works in a portfolio role as a consultant respiratory physiotherapist, national clinical advisor in respiratory for NHS England, and as the head of clinical leadership development for the NHS Leadership Academy. She was the first non-medical president of the British Thoracic Society. In 2021, she received an OBE for her services to the NHS, and just a year later, she was awarded with an honorary doctorate by the University of Hertfordshire. Super impressive. Welcome to the podcast. Rachel, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Brie. I'm delighted.
Oh, how are you?
I'm really well, thanks. I'm really well. And do you know, you've just gave such an amazing introduction. And the first thing I just want to say is that, you know, I'm really privileged to have done a lot, but I really am just a normal person. And I know people say that, but I just want to start the podcast. You know, the people that are listening, I'm just like you on the other end of the screen, just really normal. Had a really normal upbringing, and I've just been afforded a lot of great opportunities, but most importantly, supported by great people. So thanks for having me.
No, thank you so much for saying that, because I think it's really important. And I remember being a student and an early graduate and thinking, when you hear these alumni stories, you're like, how would I get there? Is it even possible? So being reminded that, no, they're normal people like you and I, it's helpful. So thank you for that. So just taking it right back to the beginning, what made you want to pursue a degree in physiotherapy?
Oh, do you know, I always knew I wanted to help people. And my mum and dad were nurses, and they love nursing. Like, everyone bar one member of my immediate family growing up was in healthcare, were nurses, apart from my uncle, who was a firefighter. And my mum and dad said, you could be whatever you want to be in healthcare, but just not a nurse. And I was like, oh, okay. So I was exploring careers where I could really help people, and I was really into sport. And I know that's a massive cliche, you know, you want to be that person that runs on the pitch with a magic sponge. But when I started to explore physiotherapy, you know, there were so many different specialities and parts to rehabilitation and helping people. And that's kind of one of the real reasons I was drawn to the profession.
Amazing. And how was your time at Hearts studying that degree?
Oh, do you know, Hearts University is, it's just, and I'm not just saying this, it's just a really special place to study. When I went to university, which I think it was 96 or 97 I went, it was really new. So it was a really new university. And, you know, there wasn't much to read about it because it was so new. But the services and the facilities they had were amazing, and the lecturers they had were just so inspirational. You know, that's what really drew us to the university. And yeah, I just have only really, really positive, happy memories. You know, I didn't have too many challenges at universities, but I did have a couple of big life events when I was there. And again, you know, I can't fault the support from the lecturers, the support teams, my peers, you know, my colleagues, my fellow students, and the networks that existed there were really important, because they're also like a second little family, the diversity networks, and of course the sports teams or the arts teams or whatever you're into. So yeah, just really positive, happy memories. I would really encourage people, if they're, you know, they want an inclusive university, to go to.
I love that. And I would absolutely agree. I definitely felt the same. And I'm kind of glad you said that, because I feel like it's a good segue into the next question, which is, you know, you have this great time at university, which arguably you could say is somewhat of a bubble, but then you graduate and you're out in the big, scary world. So for you, what was that like? What was your first role? Like, how did your career start after graduating and leaving that almost safety net of university?
I think, you know, when I think back about my post-graduation years, I think we really take it for granted sometimes in healthcare. When you're doing a healthcare degree, you leave university with a vocational qualification. So you are skilled at X, and then you can apply for a job in X. And in healthcare, you know, you're pretty much guaranteed a job as a newly graduate. And therefore, I think getting that first career stepping stone is relatively easy, I would say, and partaking in your kind of foundation years post-training, in especially if in the NHS, is something that, you know, is open to you across the country. So you don't necessarily have to stay even in the same region that you studied. So yeah, for me, and I have to say, I'm very aware that I have a very privileged life, in the fact that, you know, I have been afforded opportunities to me across my career that have helped my progression. But that stepping stone from being what we call a junior clinician or a junior physiotherapist to stepping up into more senior positions and being given those promotions in quite a kind of steady state step fashion. And that led on to more leadership roles, you know, down the line. But also, I think as I gained more confidence in some of my senior roles, it was applying for positions or opportunities that, you know, my younger self wouldn't have done. So part of it was around just taking opportunities, applying for posts. Part of it was being given opportunities to sit on guideline groups or committees. And part of it was taking that little bit of a leap of faith in pushing the boundaries into areas maybe we hadn't been before, with regards to either females or, you know, non-medics. We work in a very medical dominated profession. So yeah, I think that it's a bit of a mixture to where I am now from where I was.
Awesome. And so I guess you kind of spoke on it already, but what does a career progression look like for a physiotherapist? What are those tiers and steps that one would take?
Yeah, so it's very similar if you're a nurse, what we call an allied health profession. So that may be a physiotherapist, an occupational therapist, a radiographer, a nurse, a midwife. You kind of have this banding system in hospitals. So you start off now with what we call a band 5, which is a newly graduate. And then you go up the bands to a 6, a 7. And then the leadership roles are banded as what we call the 8As. And to get into each of those promotional jobs, there is a certain element of skills and competencies that you have to have. But then also, as you become more senior, leadership and management qualities. And they can often actually be the things that can hold people back. Just because people might not have the opportunity to either, it's not just about going on courses, but having that leadership and management experience. And then, of course, sometimes people are just glass ceilinged because some of the systemic barriers that are in place for people in healthcare, and I'm sure other professions. But yeah, so, you know, if you work hard and have the opportunities, so it's two tier, then progressing through that, those career paths can be step by step, like I said.
Nice. And so, speaking of the healthcare and the NHS and even leadership, you've had 2 decades in the NHS now. What has that experience taught you about leadership? How did that become a skill set and almost an area of expertise for you, particularly in the NHS?
Well, I think for me and for many people, as I mentioned before, I've been afforded a lot of opportunities and privileges, and I've experienced the very, very best of NHS leadership, the very best. You know, I've had mentors, colleagues, line managers who have really nurtured me, believed in me, given me opportunities, helped me along the way. And sadly, I've also experienced the bad side of NHS leadership. And my experiences are by far not the worst people have experienced. But when you have experienced the great side of leadership and you know what it feels like, when you experience the poor or the bad sides of leadership, I think it hits hard. And it's some of those toxic traits that exist. It's some of that hierarchy that exists, the command and control behaviors, and everything we know about compassionate leadership. It's kind of like the opposite of that. So rather than making people thrive, people feel controlled. And I used to say I felt like my wings were clipped. I just wanted to grow and blossom and develop. And there was like people, things holding you back. And that can feel quite suffocating. So for me, when you get more senior in your roles and you maybe have more choice, and again, this comes back to obviously the opportunities and privileges that I have, you can choose what type of culture you want to work in. You can maybe be more selective about the team or the organisation you want to sit in, and you can be more inquisitive, say, at interviews or when you know the type of people you're going to be working with. So it becomes more of a deliberate choice rather than maybe when you're, you know, starting off in your career, it's more about having those opportunities where you can develop your skills rather than thrive in a culture and feel like you really belong.
Rachel, it's so refreshing to hear you, one, I guess, identify, but also to just acknowledge your own privileges so honestly. And I know that I feel like for all people, sometimes that's a difficult process to go through. Can you speak to having to face your own biases as a leader and addressing that in order to, help you lead a group or a team?
I think, first of all, I'd say that as in the first 10 years of my career, I thought I was inclusive. I thought I understood my biases, but really it was very tokenistic. So, you know, I am in a mixed race marriage. My auntie had severe disabilities. She's just sadly passed now. You know, I thought I knew about discrimination, but it was really just through my lens. I'd never really taken the time to really understand what it meant to face systemic discrimination, racism, transphobia, ableism. And for me, inclusive leadership is a choice because I'm white, I'm British born, and the system will afford me just because of who I am, when the system will disadvantage people just because of who they are. So I was in a London post, and it was a leadership post. I was in a clinician, I was a team leader, and I had a mentor at the time, and she was the most amazing woman. She was a black female. And that's important because when I experienced that crossroads in my career where it was a situation during an interview, and I was interviewing someone, and I give someone the job, and they looked exactly like me. They sounded like me, you know, they weren't a Geordie, but, you know, I was looking for the next me in that post. And then the second candidate wasn't white and they weren't British born, but they had, goodness, I think it was like nearly 8 years more experience than the candidate I'd give. So they were almost like too qualified for the job, but I still didn't give them the job. And when I was discussing it with my mentor, the lady I've just told you about, she told me exactly why I was feeling uncomfortable about the decision. And she pointed out the inherent biases that I had. And I strongly believe if my mentor had been a white female at the time, they would never have pointed out those biases to me. So I had to, you know, I did cry those white tears. You know, I did do that. I do admit that. And, you know, she said, this is your opportunity now to go on a journey. And, you know, I'm not going to tell you what that journey looks like because it's your journey, but you need to educate yourself. And that's what I did. And I went away and I read the books and I listened to the podcasts and I read the blogs. And then I came back to her and said, okay, this is what I need to do next. And that was 10 years ago.
Wow.
And that journey is a lifelong learning lesson. You never stop. Inclusion begins with I, and it's intentional. And that now is why I'm so passionate about inclusive leadership in particular, because we have to continue this cycle of learning, don't we? And often, you know, when I'm talking like this or having conversations like this, I know other people just like me will listen, maybe more, because it's me that's saying it. And you know, I can't educate myself. We need to do this collectively, but it shouldn't be on the burden of those that are already oppressed to educate others like me. So that's why I kind of moved into leadership roles, like non-clinical leadership roles, but still having that opportunity to have conversations and educate and be part of a really dynamic, diverse team that bring lots of different elements together. So we're all having those conversations with very different lenses, and we can all bring something together, because this is how we're going to break this systemic discrimination and the barriers that people face. And I do believe that slowly the change is happening. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely, more than. No, I'm so, so grateful for that example, because I've worked previously in EDI within the music industry, and everything you said is so valuable, mainly because it's so transferable. It's not, you know, I'm sure that there are specific nuances for healthcare, but actually the principles that you mentioned can be applied to management and leadership across the board in any corporate space. And so it's reassuring that we're having this conversation and that people are going to be able to hear and hopefully apply this in whatever sector, industry, you know, they work in, because it's really important. And I'm really grateful for your example, because I think especially 2020, with everything that was going on, lots of conversations took place. So many, everyone had kind of had like fatigue at the end of it. But it did feel like there was a lot of chat and less action. And so to hear you have the conversation with your mentor, but actually follow it up with action and make it practical, I think that is really what moves the needle. And so, yeah, it's really encouraging to hear you say that and kind of lay it out there for people, because those are the questions that I remember, you know, some people asking, like, what do we do? And I feel like you've clearly laid out what you can do. You can go out there, read, study, educate yourself, and then come back to contribute something. Again, not to do it on your own, but to work collectively. So yeah, that was amazing. Thank you so much for that. So when you received your honorary doctorate at Hearts, you spoke at the graduation and you mentioned the importance of compassion and kindness in leadership. So can you just speak to that and what you meant by that? Why are those vital parts of leadership?
Yeah, so compassion is a really interesting concept, isn't it? And if we think about leadership as a concept, we often think of it as an activity, or we think about it as a concept of someone organizing or motivating someone or a group of people to do something, to achieve a task or a goal. You think about people in leadership positions, you know, with inverted commas, who have a responsibility to kind of get a job done. But when tasks or actions become the focus of leadership, actually the kind of how you get there or how it's done becomes less important than actually doing it. And this is when we can see these kind of hierarchical leadership traits or command and control behaviors, or, you know, people not really valuing people. So people become kind of objects to achieve the said task. So when we think about leadership, and when I think about compassionate leadership or inclusive leadership, we think about compassionate leadership as a set of inclusive values and behaviors that people have. And when we think about them as values and behaviors, we think about people as humans and what can we do to bring the very best version of themselves into the workplace or into the space where we're all together, and what really matters to them. And the concepts of compassionate leadership are really basic. It's about listening to people. It's about showing empathy to people. It's about understanding people. and it's about supporting people. So these kind of domains for people. And when people receive those behaviors, or they receive them things, they feel valued, they feel respected, they feel like they belong, which is really important for the diversity and equity piece. And they also feel cared for and they feel nurtured. And of course, if you feel that, what's going to happen in your team? What's going to happen in the hospital or wherever you work? You're going to work hard. What you do matters. You know that when you come to work and you show up every day, you know what people care about what you do and how you do it. And for me, that's really important, even more so in healthcare, but you could talk about any service, like you said, any industry, because really work is a huge part of what we do. It doesn't define us, but it's a huge definition in our life. So I think that's when I think of compassionate leadership, I think about individuals getting the very best or what they need from me if I'm a leader, a manager, but also from the team and the organization that they work in. And that means very different things for different people. And when we think about inclusion, or we think about positive action, and this is the action piece that comes on the inclusive leadership journey, it's understanding that people will have had different opportunities in their life. Some people would have had more, some people would have had less. So in someone with a position of responsibility, it's about finding the people I know would have been disadvantaged by the system, by society, and offering them opportunities that otherwise they would not have had. That's a deliberate action and intention. And so that can be uncomfortable sometimes for other privileged people who don't understand and think that's given people more opportunities, but actually a level in the playing field for people. And that's a huge part of compassionate leadership, understanding the differences that people will have in life. And when people get to the same stage in life, often, and we see this in healthcare so many times, it can take a Black colleague, a trans colleague, a disabled colleague 10 years more to get to the same space. Not because they're not capable, just because they've had more barriers or they've had less opportunities afforded to them. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for that. I think that was a really helpful breakdown of what leadership is at its core. Because I think when you do hear leadership, for me anyway, synonyms are like responsibility, you know, and things that, especially as a student or early graduate, can be quite daunting. So kind of to add on to that breakdown, what advice, I guess, would you give to students and graduates who want to eventually become leaders in their field? What are kind of early steps that they can take to one day get there?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. So to kind of keep it simple, when we're introducing the concept of leadership to people, so say if people are on a development program or we were having this conversation, I would talk about values. So do you know what your values are? If you had to list your 3-4 values now, Brie, could you do that? Could you tell me what your values are? Mm-hmm. So I know mine because I talk about this all the time. But, you know, honesty is really important to me. Integrity, hard work, compassion, kindness. These are values that were instilled in me by my parents because they're nurses. They were healthcare professionals. Your values, sometimes you have from a very young age, but often they change throughout your life. And that can be a really good thing. But often your core values, especially when they're that of compassion, are really important. So that would be the first thing I would ask people. Do you know what your core values are? And can you live by them every day? And if you can't, why not? And the second piece about values is I always think is really interesting is, when you've kind of really thought about your values and you've got them written down on a bit of paper, go to your best friend or go to the person that knows you the best. It might be a parent or a loved one. It might be a partner, might be a mentor, and say, okay, if you had to list 4 values about me, what would they be? What are they? And just see how similar they are. See if they're exactly the same. See if they're widely different. And yeah, just maybe think about what that means. So that would be the first thing. And then the second bit of advice I always give, again, this goes back to the inclusion piece. So, you know, if you're listening to this and you're white, British born, you know, you don't have a disability or neurodiversity, you're heteronormative, think about your understanding of your own privileges in life. And have you been on that inclusive leadership journey? Do you understand what it's like to not have the same privileges afforded to you? And really explore that side of yourself. Because, you know, unconscious bias, it's got a place, but often people just get put on training and they do like a one-day course and yeah. It's about pictures and it's about preconceptions. For me, it's much deeper than that. It's actually understanding. And a lot of the time, as I mentioned, those types of people, you know, people like me, we don't have to go on those journeys, but it's really important that we do. And it will make you a better human. It will make you a better friend. It will make you a better partner, a better parent, whatever's important to you, if you do that. And there's for people who, especially people in working in healthcare, but any social care, anything, the NHS Leadership Academy, if you just type it into Google, you just need an email. It doesn't have to be an NHS email. You can access all of our free training and education bite-sized modules about this. So you don't have to work in healthcare, but it's out there. There's lots of other kind of bite-sized modules out there, but that's just one place you can get some kind of train and learn and listen to the podcasts and some of the other things we've got on there.
Awesome. I really love what you said, because I thought it earlier, but I'm really glad you said it again, where, you know, you just spoke of it making you a better person, and everything you described about the compassionate leadership. I thought, wow, that's not just like professional development, that's personal development as well. I feel like those are qualities that every human should have. So yeah, I think that's really powerful. Thank you so much, Rachel. I could chat about this forever. I could listen to you speak for hours. So thank you so much for your time and your honesty and for sharing your experience with us. How can we stay in touch with you? How can we, yeah, stay up to date with what you've got going on?
So I'm on Twitter. So NHS Rachel M. Okay. But yeah, I'm part of the alumni. And yeah, it's just great to be connected. And the alumni program group is just a great space to be in. So yeah, thanks for having me.
Amazing. Thank you again, Rachel.